Yeah, chapter 28 is starting a new section in the book of Isaiah for us. And it's actually five chapters that all start with the word woe. We're stepping back in time. The last chapters that we've looked at have been kind of looking at the whole world and God's judgment from the whole world. Now we're stepping back, beginning here in chapter 28, back to the time of Isaiah and Hezekiah's day and the more immediate things going on at their time. This is when Assyria was just becoming a world power. The big question in everybody's mind was, as Assyria started flexing their muscles and intimidating people in Israel, the big question was, can Egypt save us from this problem? And that's going to be coming up in the coming chapters. Egypt is going to become a major subject in the prophecy. As Isaiah tells them, no, Egypt can't deliver you from this, and you're trusting God. Verses 1 through 13 tell two stories. One's a story of glory, the other's a story of shame. Let me just read. My translation of this, and you follow along. Isaiah chapter 28. Woe, proud crown of Ephraim's alcoholic, fading flower, the glorious beauty which is upon the head of the valley of riches, overcome by wine. Look, a strong and mighty man belongs to the Lord, like a swarm of hail, a swarm of destruction, like a swarm of heavy water flooding, he is brought down to the land with a hand. The proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim will be trodden underfoot. The fading flower of the beauty of his glory, which is upon the head of the valley of riches, will be like a ripe fig before summer, which as soon as the seer sees it, it's in his hand and he swallows it. In that day, Jehovah of hosts will turn into the crown of beauty, and into the diadem of beauty for the remnant of his people, and into a spirit of justice to the one who sits over justice, and into the strength of those who turn battle toward the gate. And also these reel with wine and with alcohol, they stagger, priests and prophets reel with alcohol, they're swallowed from the wine. They stagger from the alcohol, they reel while seeing, they waver in judgment, for the tables are full of vomit and filth, and there's not a place. Who will teach knowledge? And who will cause understanding of what is heard? Those weaned from milk, those taken from the breast? For precept to precept, precept to precept, line to line, line to line, a little here, a little there, but with mocking lips and with another tongue, he will speak to the people. Which he said to them, rest, this is the rest for the weary one, this is the repose, yet he did not consent to listen. And the word of Jehovah will happen to him, precept to precept, precept to precept, line to line, line to line, little here, little there, in order that they may walk and find fall behind and be shattered and snared and taken. These verses tell two stories. There's one story, a story of shame that includes vomiting and filth and not understanding what's going on. The confusion of trying to understand a foreign language. Never getting enough rest. Getting stepped on, turning ugly, losing respect, getting eaten for lunch, falling down and being captured. That's the story of shame. There's also the story of glory here that speaks of glory, beauty, wearing a crown, getting rest when you're tired, understanding what's going on, being the head, being strong, surviving, everything turning out right, finding justice, and being victorious in battle. The question is, how do we get in on the story of glory instead of the shameful ending? We start out with these two glorious things that God has made. Verse 1 and verse 2 describe two glorious things God has made. And verse 1, we have Ephraim, the northern kingdom of Israel, the capital of which was Samaria. Talks about beauty which is on the head of a valley of riches in the northern kingdom. of the Jezreel Valley. And the capital city was up on the side of that valley, kind of up on a hill, and it was drained by a wall. And so, kind of metaphorically, it was, you know, up on a hill with a wall around it, kind of like a crown sitting on the head of a person. And the rich valley spreading out below them is near the body of the person. This is a glorious thing God made. God blessed Israel. He made Israel and blessed them. But they were not entering into the story of God's glory. They were looking for glory in other places. It talks about in chapter 10, Assyria being the places that people look to for glory. And chapter 13 talks about Babylon being a place that people look to for glory. Chapter 20, Egypt is a place that people look to for glory. Chapter 23, Tyre. And God said to Tyre that his purpose is to defile the cultural pride of all glory and bring it down. The people that are collecting glory for themselves and taking all the glory and blessings God has given them and using it for only for themselves, that's going to bring an end to that. So here's one glorious creation, the nation of Israel. And verse 2, we have this other glorious creation. It's a mighty man, a strong and mighty man that belongs to the Lord, it says. And describes him as like a hailstorm, a terrifying storm of destruction. Flowing flood of water. The adjective, there's not a, verse 2 is not explicit in telling us exactly who this person is, but it's generally agreed by commentators that it's probably referring to Assyria. We're looking at a strong and mighty nation that is threatening Israel at this time. The picture of the water flooding, it reminds me of the story of Noah, and it's part of the pattern of God's work, bringing when God's people turn away from Him, it's God's pattern to bring chastisement, and like that happened in the time of Noah. Flood that wiped out the wicked, and God preserved his righteous people and gave them his heart. God's going to do the same thing to the nation of Israel. He's going to wipe them out, preserve them, and give them his heart. But we've already seen in chapter 4 and in chapter 25 that God promises to be a refuge in the midst of the storm like this. So the storm is coming, yes, but there is a refuge coming, and that is by trusting in God. Then we get to verse 3 and 4, and we have the collision of these two glorious creatures, kind of like the Calvin and Hobbes comic strip, where in the first frame he's driving the sleek, fast car, and in the next frame he's out the woods driving the huge steep cliff, and in frame 3, fast car meets steep cliff, and big guy. And this is what happens in verse 3. The crowd, the dust drunkards of Ephraim, trodden underfoot, fading flower of music of his glory, swallowed like a ripe fig. Immediately. Those who enjoy the gifts of God, despise the giver of those gifts. Those who are trying to enjoy glory for themselves, but are not enjoying that in the context of God graciously giving to them and giving glory to them, God will bring those people down. They will be being cut off. And interestingly enough, what comes around goes around for Assyria, too, just as Assyria came in and brought him to Israel. God used similar language in the book of I fall under the mouth of the heater. God is just, and even though Assyria brought an end to the Israelite nation, God did the same sort of thing to the Assyrian nation later on. What is the goal for Paul this? Why would there even be a collision of these two glorious creations, Assyria and Israel? Why would they even be this collision? We talked about this a bit last week, as well as many other times before, but the point is for God to be glorified. We talked about last week, I think the last verse had to do with God wanting people to come and worship Him, and that was the bottom line of all that He was doing. This is it right here in verses 5 and 6. From that day, Jehovah's host will become, and it will be four things in verses 5 and 6. A crown of beauty, and this crown is in contrast to the crown that's mentioned in verse 1, where the crown is being used to bring glory selfishly to the people of Israel. This is the crown of beauty that's not going to fade away. The second thing is a diadem of beauty for the remnant of the people. This concept of the remnant is being brought back after having been mentioned earlier in Isaiah chapter 10, verse 20. In that day, the remnant of Israel will lean on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel in truth. The remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. And chapter 4, in that day the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the Lamb shall be the pride and honor of the survivors of Israel. This is God's goal, is for God Himself, His Son Jesus, to be the one that is glorified, the diadem of beauty, the Holy Host, to become the diadem of beauty for also, verse 6, becomes a spirit of justice to the one who sits over justice. It is God who empowers judges to judge justice. In Isaiah chapter 4, verse 3, he who is left in Zion will be called holy, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion by a spirit of judgment. This is that same phrase, spirit of judgment. In this case, the Holy Spirit, in Isaiah 4, the Spirit of judgment washes away the filth of God's people. The way that this is worded, Spirit of justice, the one who sits over justice, and there may be that I gave it a little literal rendering, and there may be other in the Bible, but the picture creates a picture of somebody sitting in a judge's chair and rendering judgment from the judge's chair, sitting in it, and they are over, they have an oversight over the judge's system. And we've already seen this justice connected with Jesus in earlier chapters of Isaiah, chapter 9, verse 7, and chapter 16, verse 5, we have the Messiah being the one who will rule the nation with justice. And we also see this in the New Testament, in the Romans, chapter 14, verse 10, and also in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10, both of them say that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. And Jesus is the one who ultimately is going to be the judge, who is going to make justice happen in a wonderful way, a perfect way. So this is God, Jesus is going to become a judge, a perfect judge. He's also the fourth thing, also in verse 6, becomes strength to the warrior. This is strength. This strength is also mentioned in Isaiah 11 regarding the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might. Same word, strength, might. light of those who turn vows toward the gate. It's hard to tell exactly what Isaiah had in mind here, and different people have different ideas. The word gate has a suffix on the end of it, which in Hebrew can be used to indicate direction toward or away from. There's something about, you know, the orientation towards the gate. We've seen this exact same spelling, the word gate with this directional suffix on it, in chapter 22, verse 7, where Isaiah is saying that the foreign armies, when they come in, are going to arrange their horsemen towards the gate. A lot of people think that this is the warrior is meeting the enemy who's arranged at his gate and fighting them off, defending his fortress. Another way to take this would be instead of defensive, something offensive. The conqueror returns victoriously from the battle and comes back to his own gate saying, "I won. God gave you the strength and I won." And that picture is pictured in chapter 26, verse 2, where it says, "Open the gates that the righteous may come in." These are the victorious righteous coming back into their own city. Either way, the emphasis is on the fact that God becomes the strength of his people. And in that strength, he'll become victorious. Verse 7 changes to the other story, the story of Cain. "Also these, reel with wine, and the strong drink and stagger. Prophet and priest, reel with strong drink. They swallow from the wine, they stagger from the strong drink. They reel while seeing, they waver in judgment. The table is full of filth and vomit, and there is no place." Don't believe anyone who tells you it's fun to get drunk. He's either got something to sell you or something to prove, and either way, it's not going to be good for you. The picture of people staggering around and throwing up on the table is gross. It's disgusting, but it's realistic. That is what happened. I've heard enough stories from friends who were involved in that. The idea uses perfect senses here. And the perfect sense in Hebrew is indicated completeness of action. They reel, they stumble, they are swallowed, they waver. But the tables are full, indicating this is completely given over to their addiction to alcohol and to the whole lifestyle of it. They're completely given over to this. Kind of ironic. The thing that they swallow, the alcohol they swallow, it says that's the thing that's swallowing them. Now, part of the tragedy of this situation is that their alcoholism is something that is preventing them from fulfilling God's will for their lives. Prophets and priests that are drunk. It's not just the down and outers, the prophets and priests. This is hitting every level of society, including the people who are supposed to be leading. The phrase "also these" seems to indicate that we've been looking at Hebrew on the crown upon the hill. "Also these" seems to also shift focus to be looking south down into the city of Judah and saying, yeah, in Judah they've got the same problem. "Also these." The Micah 2:11, speaking of people in Jerusalem, says, "If a man should say, I will preach to you about wine and strong drink," well, he'd be a good preacher for this people. But, you know, they've got problems with alcohol, says Micah. And he's already mentioned the drunkenness of the leaders in Isaiah 5. Isaiah has already mentioned it in Isaiah chapter 5, 11, 12, 22, also in chapter 22, 24. Why is the mocker? The proverb tells us. Why is the mocker strong drink? The brawler, whoever is led astray by it, is not wise. Now that's not to say that there's not a place for drinking wine. The woman who personifies wisdom in Proverbs chapter 9 serves wine and invites simple people to come and drink it. The prophet spoke of wine being enjoyed in heaven in Jeremiah 31, Joel 2, Amos 9, Isaiah 56. Of course, Jesus made wine and he drank wine. Paul told Timothy to drink wine from his stomach and then him. The point is not so much vilifying God's creation. There's another creation through the vine. The point is not so much to vilify what God has created, as it is that any gift of God, when enjoyed to excess, can lead us astray. Here we have priests and prophets who are supposed to lead God's people in his way, but they're instead so smashed with alcohol that they cannot lead. In Leviticus chapter 10, there are specific rules against prophets and priests drinking alcohol while on duty. It slows your brain down, it slows down your whole metabolism, and so you're not able to function at your top ability. And so God said, don't tempt that stuff when you leave your mind sharp, when you're on duty, and teach. The result of this addiction to alcohol results in a couple of problems. One of them is total incompetence in the people, among the people, and ignorance. That's in verse 9. So who will teach knowledge? And who will cause to understand what has occurred? Those who eat from milk or things from breast. In other words, there is nobody who teaches peace. The prophets and priests are all drunk. There's nobody qualified to teach. The only people that aren't drunk are the people, are the babies that are still nursing. They haven't had any alcohol yet. Now that is my take on how to interpret this. There's a lot of people take the word food in verse 9 and make it an indirect object. And they put the focus on who will you teach it to? Isaiah, there's nobody you can teach to, nobody's going to listen. I think it's more natural for the word to be taken as the subject of the verb to teach and understand, and focus through on the teacher. Who's going to teach if nobody's capable of teaching? Chapter 56 of Isaiah, verse 11. They are shepherds who have no understanding. They've all turned their own way. Come, they say, let me get wine. Let us fill ourselves with strong drink. You're the leader of Israel, saying, getting drunk and unable to shepherd. They have no understanding. God says, in chapter 6, verse 10, that there's, God is shutting down their understanding and make the heart of the people dull, make their ears heavy, make blind their eyes, let them see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn to these people. Chapter 29, verse 14, the discernment of their discerning men shall be hidden. Chapter 24, verse 18, they know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes so they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. As these people have rebelled against God, giving themselves over to debauchery, that shuts down their understanding. understanding and their ability to understand that word. But there is hope. God still provides a way, and He says prophesies, and there will come a time when the heart, when their hearts will understand and know, the tongue of the stammerer will speak fluently, and chapter 2. Chapter 2, Isaiah speaks of a time where the people go up to the mountain of Jehovah, that He may teach us His ways, and we may walk in His paths, down Zion, out of Zion, shall go walk. And there even is a place, I don't think that we should misunderstand this passage to say that children are incapable of understanding God and trusting in God. Kind of asking a facetious question, who's going to be teaching because everybody's drunk. But there's, in chapter 29, some of these same words can be Psalm chapter 22, verses 9 and 10 says, "You took me out of the womb, and you made me trust when I was upon my mother's breast. You have been my God since my mother's womb." There is a place for even young children but these people aren't trusting in God. They're smashed with alcohol. Their understanding is shutting down. And so when they hear Isaiah preach, they don't get the message. They're not understanding it. And so we have this little sing-song phrase here. He steps on precept, line on line, a little here, a little there. I think this is the drunk people criticizing and mocking Isaiah. They're accusing him of legalism, precept, but King James uses order as in a command order. The American Standard uses their do and do, so the NIV. Do this, do that. There's all these commands. They're hearing from Isaiah, and they're like, we don't want you telling us what to do. You're being a legalist, Isaiah. Line on line, line to line. The line is a measuring tool. And in verse 7 of this chapter, it's the standard for judgment. The line is the standard by which judgment is made, right, which is wrong. In Isaiah 44, it's a measuring tool that for a carpenter to measure and do his work accurately. People don't like being held accountable for standards. They don't like to be held accountable for a standard of truth and justice. They want to wiggle out of that. And then there's a little bit here, a little there. They're picking up bits and pieces of the message, but they're not understanding the big picture. And part of it is because they don't want to. They're rebelling against God. They don't want to understand. And they hear a little thing here, a little thing there, and it's not coming together, and then they'll go criticize, the things they heard. Not really understanding what God's message to them is. This is typical. In Acts 17, we have people that were like this. There was the philosopher in Athens, and Paul comes and preaching the gospel, and the philosopher said, what does this babbler wish to say? We don't understand what he's saying. He picked up these couple things here and there, and said, what is this babbler saying? Seems to be advocating for God. People don't always understand. Those who are in rebellion against God are not going to pick up necessarily on the whole message. I remember I was struck by when I was watching the interview of the different actors in the movie recently. The recent movie that came out, this is Vienna, played Martin Luther. you know, at the end of this wonderful movie that's talking about the roots of our Protestant faith, Ms. Deanna comes out in an interview and answering the question, what was this movie about? And he says, well, it's about how you can't keep man down. Sooner or later, you gain knowledge and you're liberated. And you know what? He missed it. I mean, how immersed was he in that script? And totally missed the point. That is the natural mind. When I was. Have you ever tried to share the gospel with a drunk man? I tried that once when I was one of my first years in college. We went downtown and we were looking for people we could witness to. And there's this man sitting on the bench. And so I started talking to him. And he was very agreeable. Everything I said, I started realizing after a while, this guy's drunk. He doesn't even know what I'm saying. That's the way it is. The minds of people who are in rebellion against God are not able to understand it all. And we should not, we should expect a certain amount of mindless criticism of our message because we don't expect them to read it all. Verses 11 and 12, we have the cure for this painful condition. Verses 11 and 12. One cure is discipline. God brings discipline to his people, to the antagonistic form, the Syrians are going to come in and wipe them out. So with mocking lip and with another tongue, we speak to his people. The word translated strange in the English Standard Foreign NIV or stammering in King James is translated mocking pretty much everywhere else in the Old Testament. And that's true, and I think it's spot on in translating the word contemptuous. One place that is found in Psalm 22, all the king who laughed at me is born, they shoot out the lips and take the head. It's derision, mocking lip, another tongue, derision that they're experiencing. Later on, we're going to see in Isaiah chapter 37, we're going to see the Assyrian army captain coming in, speaking in Hebrew, but mocking the God of Israel and the king of Judah and the city of Jerusalem. Hosea talks about this. Hosea chapter 7. The pride of Israel testifies to his faith. Ephraim is silly and without sense. Going to Egypt, going to Assyria. I will bring them down like birds to heaven. I will discipline them according to the report made to their congregation. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. For grain and wine they jack themselves. They rebel against me. The princes will fall by the sword because of the insolence of their tongue, and this shall be their derision in the land of Egypt. God brings it to shame as far as his punishment. The other part of the cure is the gospel, and that's verse 12. Verse 12, he says to them, rest. This is the rest for the weary one. This is the repose. Rest is to be found where God is. Rest is found in faith and obedience to God. Chapter 11, verse 10. In that day, the root of Jesse, he shall stand as a signal for the people. Of him shall the nations inspire, and his resting place shall be glorious. And word used here. Deuteronomy 28:65. Among these nations, you will find no rest. That's not where you find rest, by getting the support of a tree from another nation. You don't find rest from the other nation. 51. Chapter 51, verse 4, Isaiah says, give ear to me, O my nation, for a law shall go forth for me, and I will cause my justice to make rest. God is the one who brings rest. And yet they would not, they will not do. you have to do is consume a will that would not. Tied into the first half of the verse, because is a form of death. Saying, okay, I trust. That's a form of resting. If you're willing and listen, you shall eat of the good of the land, God promised in Isaiah chapter 1. And yet, this is a rebellious people, lying children who are unwilling to hear the law of God. Jesus lamented over Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the children's prophets. How often would I have gathered your children as a hen gathers the brood under her wings, and you would not. God had told the Jews not to go to war against Syria. He told them not to impose taxes to begin a treaty with Egypt to protect them against Syria. They did it anyway, and they're reaping the results. They're losing their rest as a result. They should have just followed his word. They should have found peace from him. And so we have the terrible conclusion of the story of Cain in verse 13. And so the word of Jehovah will happen to them. And here we get the same little rhyme, precept on precept, line on line. But here God is, I think, God is saying, well, you don't, you're mocking my word. Well, you're not going to understand any better than that. This is all you're going to get. Precept on precept, line on line. I'm gonna keep you confused about this whole thing, so that you will stumble and fall into their pasture. When we harden our hearts in rebellion against God, God gives us over to a depraved mind. There's a story in C.S. Lewis's book, The Magician's Nephew, that illustrates this. It'll explain itself enough. We must go back a bit and explain what the whole scene had looked like from Uncle Andrew's point of view. And had not made at all the same impression on him as on the cabbie and the children. For what you see and hear depends a good deal on where you're standing. It also depends on what sort of person you are. Now, ever since the animals had first appeared, Uncle Andrew had been shrinking further and further back into the thicket. He watched them very hard, of course. But he wasn't really interested in seeing what they were doing, only in seeing whether they were going to make a rush at him. Like the witch, he was dreadfully practiced. He simply didn't notice that Aslan was choosing one pair out of every kind of beast. All he saw, or thought he saw, was a lot of dangerous wild animals walking vaguely about. And he kept on wondering why the other animals didn't run away from the big lion. And when the great moment came and the beast spoke, but he missed the whole point for a rather interesting reason. So when the lion had first begun singing long ago, when it was still quite dark, he had realized that the noise was a song, and he had disliked that song very much. It made him think and feel things he did not want to think and feel. Then, when the sun rose and he saw the singer was a lion, only a lion, well, he tried his hardest to make believe it wasn't singing, and never had been singing, only roaring as any lion might in a zoo in our world. Of course, it can't really have been singing, he thought. I must have imagined it. I've been letting my nerves get out of order. Whoever has a lion singing? And the longer and more beautiful the lion sang, the harder Uncle Andrew tried to make himself believe that he could hear nothing but roaring. Now, the trouble about trying to make yourself stupider than you really are is that you very often succeed. And Uncle Andrew did. He soon did hear nothing but roaring in Aslan's song. And soon he couldn't have heard anything else even if he'd wanted to. And when at last the lion spoke and said, Narnia, awake, he didn't hear any words. He only heard a snarl. And when the beast spoke in answer, he always heard only barkings and growlings and bayings and howlings. And when they laughed, well, you can imagine. That was worse for Uncle Andrew than anything that had happened yet. Such a horrid, bloodthirsty din of hungry, angry brutes he'd never heard in his life. God gives us over to a depraved mind when we rebel against him. Isaiah has already talked about some of this end of being snared and taken in chapter 8. Do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread. the Lord of hosts, him you shall regard as holy. Let him be your fear, let him be your dread, and he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and many shall stumble thereon and fall and be broken and snared and be taken. To those who reject the word of the Lord, he is ordained mocking, stumbling, and utter ruin. Ephesians 4:18 talks about how people darken in their understanding, alienated from the life of God, because of the ignorance of the kingdom and the hardening of their heart. Proverbs 13:15 says, the way of a transgressor is hard, is the truth. And the historical fulfillment of this, we can read in 1 Kings 18, where in the 4th year of King Hezekiah, which is the 7th year of Hoshea, son of Ela, king of Israel, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it, and at the end of 3 years he took it. The king of Assyria gave the Israelites away to Assyria because they did not obey the voice of the Lord their God. He transgressed his covenant, and he had listened to more of faith. That's the end of this section, but it's not the end of the story, is it? We're able to look at the big picture flow of history and see that this story of shame is actually just a chapter in God's story of glory. Chronologically, verses 7 through 13 should go in between verses 4 and 5. We see from the rest of the scripture, the capture and exile of the Jews was not the end of the story. It was followed by a restoration of a faithful remnant with two verses of the church. The end of the story really is verses 4 and 5 of the chapter. In that day, Jehovah of hosts will turn into a crown of beauty and into a diadem of beauty for the remnant of his people, and into a spirit of justice for the one who sits over justice, and the strength of those who turn battle towards the gate. So we go back to this question I started out with. How do we get in on this story of glory? Let me highlight three things that are suggested by this passage. First, rest. It's a command, rest. In verse 12, rest. Rest is the rest of the world. This is the first. Speaking of trust in Jesus, Jesus said, come unto me, all you that are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Rest by Hebrews chapter 4 talks about this rest. The good news came to us just as it did to them. But the message they heard did not benefit them because they were not united by faith with those who listened. But you who have believed enter into that rest. When we believe, we enter into the rest. We enter into that story of glory. The second question that's asked of candidates for baptism in President Christian America also talks about rest. Do you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Savior of sinners, and do you receive and rest on Him alone for your salvation as He is offering His gospel? Receive and rest on Him alone for salvation as He is offering His gospel. That is what we're called to, first of all, rest. We can rest upon Jesus alone as our Savior. The second thing we can do in response to this is to humbly submit and worship God. Verse 1 has the word proud right out towards the front. Woe to the proud crown of Israel. Let Jesus become your crown of glory. Let the glory and honor be His, not yours. Let Him be beautiful and glorious in the pride and honor of you. Worship God wholeheartedly in your prayer and scripture reading and singing. In your conversations with others, don't be thinking about how you can impress other people and draw glory to yourself, but think about how can I shift honor to God and impress people with how great He is. So rest. Rest on Jesus alone for salvation. Humbly to go and worship Him. Don't be proud. Let Jesus be your friend. And then the third thing, throw off the sins and entangles case of Israel here in this chapter, it was alcoholic. Priest and prophet, real with alcoholic, swallowed from the wine, staggered from the alcohol, the waves of judgment. What sins do we allow to hamper our ability to fulfill God's calling? The priests were allowing their addiction to alcohol to prevent them from being able to do what God is calling them to do, and that was to teach God's law. What things do we do to hamper our ability to fulfill God's calling in our lives? I don't know. It could be alcohol, any other drug, food, seeking acceptance from other people, money, academics, could even be an idolatrous preoccupation with our children. It's so easy we can get off track by taking any one of God's good things and becoming preoccupied with that and trying to draw glory for ourselves through that. So often, all we like sheep have gone astray, and that word that Isaiah used, gone astray, is the same word as used in verse 7 to describe the staggering and reeling from alcohol. This is what he sin does. It causes us to stumble and get astray. All we like sheep have gone astray, but the Lord has laid on him, Jesus, the iniquity of us all. When we look to Jesus as the Lord, see us from those sins and come to us. Then we can do what Micah 11 says, arise and go, for this is no place to rest, because the uncleanliness is destroyed with egregious destruction. It's no place to rest. When you realize the sin that you're in, and realize that Jesus can forgive you from that and free you from it, then you can get up and go away from it and say, that was no place for me to rest. Hebrews chapter 12 also talks about this. Therefore, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set